research, opioid testing information was unavailable in half of injury death investigations in the U.S. in 2021, and in only about 1 out of 10 unintentional overdose death investigations that were conducted that year. This at a time when the autopsy rate, that is, the percentage of deaths for which a medical examination is performed, is at all-time lows. According to a 2023 report by the Federal Centers for Disease Control, from 2003 through 2020, the autopsy rate in the U.S. has hovered between a high of 8.7% in 2006 and 2007 and a low of 7.4% in 2020. Percentages, of course, are really only meaningful if you have the underlying numbers. So, in 2020, according to the CDC, there were 3,383,729 deaths in the U.S., of which 249,337 were autopsied. That's an average of 683 autopsies per day. In 2007, when the autopsy rate hit 8.7%, according to the CDC, there were a total of 2,298,608 deaths in the U.S., of which 199,154 were autopsied. That's an average of about 546 per day. To learn more, I spoke recently with Dr. Alexander Lundberg. He's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and the lead author of a research letter published February 19th in the journal JAMA entitled Percentage of Opioid Tests Available in U.S. Injury Death Investigations 2021. Dr. Lundberg, welcome.
Thank you, Doug.
So let's start from the top. What was the purpose of your study? What were you trying to learn?
Well, for the backdrop, we know that drug overdose deaths in the United States have increased dramatically over the last 20 years by a factor of 5 or 6. And we also know that in the United States, we have a patchwork system of death investigation, which we wanted to explore to see whether we think that the system is doing a good job of accurately tallying these drug overdose deaths or not.
So what did you look at?
So we looked at a combination of data sources. One is called the National Violent Death Reporting System. This tabulates information on every individual death in the United States if the cause of death was an injury. That could be something like a homicide, suicide, and more recently, an outgrowth of that system called SUDORS, the State Unintentional Drug Overdose Reporting System, which includes unintentional drug overdose deaths.
What did you find?
We were interested in specifically looking at how often we test for the presence of opioids within these deaths. And what we found was that in a slight majority of cases for the year 2021, for data abstractors, they could not tell whether a test was done, or in some cases, a test was not done. And by test, we mean these are forensic toxicology tests where we look at biological samples to test for various either legal or illegal substances. And in this case, we looked at the class of opioids.
Were there any characteristics you were able to identify among the deaths that where tox tests were performed versus the ones that weren't?
So far in this study, what we looked at was differences by death manner. And by death manner, we mean whether it was an unintentional drug overdose death, or it was a suicide or homicide, or in other cases, whether the death investigator, a coroner medical examiner, could not determine the intent of the death. And we found pretty substantial variation in the availability of opioid tests by death manner. For the lowest rate that we observed was for the unintentional overdose deaths, which makes sense. We've only found that opioid tests were unavailable for about 13% of those cases, compared to cases of non-poisoning suicide, for which we saw a rate of 65% of unavailable opioid test information.
So people who they turned up dead, but we don't know necessarily if they were under the influence or...
For the case of unintentional drug overdose deaths, death investigators did feel confident in assigning a classification to these deaths that it was caused by an unintentional drug overdose death. But we do not yet know what factors they might use to make that categorization if they don't have access to opioid information within a forensic toxicology test. In other cases, with death manners like non-poisoning suicide, where we see very high rates of unavailable opioid test information, it remains unclear whether opioids were involved in those deaths or not.
What are the implications of this? I guess first in terms of the data. I mean, we see reports about overdose deaths quite frequently, not as frequently as used to. And most recently, we've seen that the CDC's provisional numbers have been showing a possible decline. And that's good news. But should we be taking that good news with a grain or two of salt?
That's a great question. Researchers are still debating what might be the cause of this apparent decline over the last year, which is really substantial. The CDC has reported about a 20% decline in the national overdose death rate. Now, in our study, it is a snapshot of one period in time, and it does suggest we may be missing some deaths that do involve opioids. But to answer the broader trend question, we'll have to do subsequent analyses looking at this over time to see if that could explain anything to do with the drop, or if we just have kind of a systematic undercount, maybe we miss 5% of these deaths every year, in which case there still is a very real decline. It's just that our underlying core numbers are perhaps a bit lower than they should be.
Now, in terms of policy, what are the implications? I can think of one right offhand, which is that we probably need to provide more support to medical examiners' offices at the state and county level if we're only managing an autopsy rate of 7.4%, anyway, but what do you think? What are the implications in terms of policy?
I think that is a direct policy implication, which is how do we support death investigation offices to conduct perhaps more thorough investigations? I think the wrong way to think about this would be that death investigators are doing a halfway job or not doing the job to their best ability. When our team speaks with investigators, we think they really make a sincere effort to investigate every death to the best of their ability. However, resource constraints are very real, especially in some counties where the jurisdiction may not be as affluent. They may not have as much money to be able to do things like conduct autopsies or tests. And when we talk to them, they often say resource constraints are a factor, so that if a death looks like a kind of obvious implication, maybe something looks like cardiac arrest or a different kind of outcome, that they might go ahead and make that determination because they have to manage resources and they can only perform so many autopsies or perform so many toxicology tests. So I think making sure the system is funded for death investigation is a really important policy implication. I would also argue that more broadly, these results highlight the importance of our health tracking systems in general. We really need to be able to identify the causes of death and be able to track these things over time so that we can initiate outreach to areas and people that need it to try to prevent things like overdose death.
Just to put some of the numbers in perspective for folks, I'm looking at that CDC report, which in 2020, we had a total of 3,383,729 deaths in the U.S. All right, COVID, fine. In 2019, we had 2,854,838 deaths reported in the U.S. I mean, that's a heck of a lot of people.
Yes, certainly the COVID-19 pandemic created excess strain on death investigation offices. They often did not have the capacity to perform a truly thorough investigation of every death. They only have so many resources, so much personnel. And I would mention here, when we're looking at something like the overdose deaths, it is a fraction of the overall deaths in the United States. But we're still talking on the order of 100,000 people dead annually, which is really a huge human tragedy, loss of life. You know, that number has gone up dramatically over the last two decades. But there is some encouragement, which is that over the last year, we've seen about that 20% decline in overdose deaths, where we're at a high of about 110,000, 112,000, now down to more towards 88,000, 90,000.
What have I not asked yet that I should have?
I guess a couple questions to potentially ask would be, when we look at the autopsy rate, that has dropped in half since the 1970s. But here we are also looking at forensic toxicology reports, which are more common than autopsy in general. And we do believe that those have become more common over time, but we still are seeing cases where in our data systems, we either have not conducted a forensic toxicology report, or perhaps it was conducted, but that information is somehow lost and does not enter into the data system, which is still a problem from a research policy perspective, because we still lose the information about how many people are dying and why they are dying, so that we can initiate health programs to try to limit this type of death. I guess, you know, one question that might be important to ask is, as we work to identify the causes of this recent decline in overdose deaths, what are some potential factors and ways we can continue to reduce overdose deaths? On that point, the science is in that medication-assisted treatment, or sometimes also called medications for opioid use disorder, are very effective ways to reduce overdose death. These are where we have drugs like buprenorphine, methadone, that we can use to help people reduce dependence or addiction on an opioid. And these drugs have been shown to be very effective. So some researchers might argue that a lot of the decline might be driven by our policies finally catching up, where we've made these types of medications more accessible to people. We've also made Narcan, which is a drug that can reverse an opioid overdose, much more available at the community level. And perhaps this is a bright point that we have finally made some progress in reducing these types of deaths. There are alternative explanations. One could be that there's a cohort death effect where a lot of the at-risk population has died over time, and that is really what's explaining the drop in overdose death rates. To answer those kind of questions, we need more research. This is a very early field at the moment.
Do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners? And again, folks, we have been speaking to Dr. Alexander Lundberg, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine.
For closing thoughts, I would encourage us all to continue to take a scientific perspective as we try to mitigate this problem of overdose death across the United States. You know, historically, there is a lot of stigma around drug use, and that has been a big impediment to progress in treating this as a medical condition and preventing overdose death. I am encouraged lately over the last decade where we have many more policies. We have interesting collaborations where law enforcement is getting more involved in the medical side as well, rather than treating drug use as so purely type of criminal moral failing, right? This is a problem when you look at 100,000 overdose deaths per year that affects a huge part of the U.S. population. And it is very important for us to keep continuing to find ways and policies that treat people with respect and reduce the damage that some of this harmful drug use can cause.
Dr. Lundberg, thanks.
Thank you again, Doug.
That was my conversation with Dr. Alexander Lundberg, an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and lead author of a research letter published February 19th in the journal JAMA entitled Percentage of Opioid Tests Available in U.S. Injury Death Investigations 2021. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined today by Tish Odell, the consulting director at the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. We're here to discuss her organization's work on laws supporting the rights of nature and a bill on that topic that is making its way through the New York State Legislature. Welcome to the show, Tish.
Thanks for having me, Althea.
Yeah, thank you for coming on to talk with us. So the New York Assembly is considering a bill that's called the Great Lakes and State Waters Bill of Rights. That's in their current session, which your organization has helped to write. So get us up to speed. What is this bill all about?
Well, actually, this is the latest version of the bill. It was introduced 2 years ago as just the Great Lakes Bill of Rights, so it only focused on the Great Lakes. And the legislator who introduced it, Patrick Burke, it's an interesting story because it goes all the way back to 2019 when people in Toledo, we worked with them to pass by the people, a vote of the people, the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. And Patrick Burke is in New York, but he's in Buffalo, which is also on Lake Erie. And he happened to see, you know, the media attention. The Lake Erie Bill of Rights got a lot of media attention. And he saw that, and he took a version from it, pulled it offline, and kind of, you know, crafted it, you know, just changed it to New York and had introduced that, which we didn't know about. So what happened is the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, if you don't know the story, it was challenged within 12 hours of the people passing it in a vote, by, you know, on a ballot measure. And it took a year, but it was overturned by a federal judge in 2020. And Patrick Burke contacted us after that, and he said, you know what, I need you to help me draft a Great Lakes Bill of Rights now, because just Lake Erie isn't enough. All the Great Lakes are interconnected. And I kind of chuckled, and I said, well, did you hear that the Lake Erie Bill of Rights was overturned by the federal judge? And he goes, yeah, I know that, but we need to keep pursuing this. I mean, this is important, and now I realize that, you know, one lake isn't enough. And so that's kind of the backstory. So and this isn't normally how our work unfolds. We usually get calls from a community group or some concerned residents saying that, you know, their harm is coming to their community, whether it's fracking or a, you know, logging project or whatever, and saying, can you help us? So this was unusual for us to have a state legislator contact us to help draft a bill. So we did it, and we got criticism from some, you know, people in New York because, well, it should include this, or it should have this in it. And so that's why we worked for 2 years then with community members to get their input, both indigenous, non-indigenous, people who lived along the Great Lakes. And so this version that's been introduced now is that version that has input from the community.
If it does pass the New York legislature, how would it change the legal landscape around these bodies of water?
Well, I mean, I think what's important, people need to they don't have an understanding of how the law currently works. And, you know, I work for a public interest law firm. And so people think, well, you just go to court and, you know, that's how this works. And we have the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Water Act. And so we already have things that should be working. And I kind of, you know, chuckle because I think, well, okay, we have 50 plus years now of experience with those. And how is that working? Are the waters being protected? Because the latest on, I think, the EPA's website directly even suggests that over 45% of the rivers, lakes, and streams in this country are too polluted to swim in, to fish in, or to drink from. So I would say they're not working. And so we, you know, did the analysis and other people working on rights of nature and said, okay, what is the problem here? Why aren't those laws protecting the water? What do we need to do differently? And part of the problem is the bodies of water themselves and the people in the communities that depend on those bodies of water have no voice. They're actually invisible under the law, especially when a project is proposed that's coming and the people know this is going to harm their community and the waters of that community. You can't get into court to stop it in any way. And people say to me, well, but we have public hearing. And I'm like, yeah, you have a public hearing, and that's part of the process and the checklist on the application for the permit that the corporation that's doing the project or the government that's doing the project, that they have to complete. That's a checklist item that says, did you hold a public hearing? And so they do, and people go and they tell all their, you know, reasons why it shouldn't happen, whatever the project is. And then they go home and they feel good like they did their part. But what they don't realize is they probably threw those in the trash can when you walked out the door and they shut off the lights. I mean, there's nothing requiring in the system, the legal system and the government system, for them to do anything with those comments. So that's why the projects go in, even though you'll read, like, you know, articles, well, 99% of the comments voiced at the hearing were against the project, and then you read the next day, you know, well, the permit was issued. So that's, again, you have to have an understanding of how our system currently works to understand how rights of nature in this New York bill could change it. So the way the law, if it was passed, would work, because if you read the language in it, it recognizes the rights of the waters of New York to exist, flourish, and thrive. And you have to have the rights recognized before you could get into court to say those rights are being violated. So we can think of it in terms of humans, right? So like in human movements before for rights expansions, like a woman before she was recognized as having any rights in this country couldn't go to court and say, wait a minute, my husband's violating my rights, or this business is, you know, because they're not recognized. So, you know, if you think of it in those terms, right now nature and the waters of has no rights recognized. So you can't try to stop things for violating nature's rights.
I'm curious, can you tell me a little bit about the history of how the Great Lakes and other New York rivers have been polluted or impacted in these ways such that establishing rights of nature for them is so important?
Yeah, and I know, because I don't know how much other people in the country, you know, like, know about the Great Lakes, but it is, I mean, the largest freshwater source of water in the world, and it's the Five Lakes, and they've been under tremendous threat for decades and decades. And actually, I'm located actually in Cleveland, Ohio, and it's interesting because Cleveland, if you've ever heard of the Cuyahoga River and it burning back in the 60s and 70s, that's what actually was part of the catalyst for the current, you know, the environmental movement that did the Clean Water Act and things like that, and the Environmental Protection Agency being formed. So it's kind of interesting, and it's because we were polluting during the whole Industrial Revolution period up through that time with industry so much of the waters of the Great Lakes regions and bioregions and watersheds. And so, you know, it's Detroit, the auto manufacturing and the steel manufacturing and all that. And so they've been under threat for a long time. And so we thought then we would clean some of these things up with those laws that were passed. And we actually did for a period. But the problem is people kind of thought, well, okay, the problem's fixed. The river's not catching on fire, which is a very low standard. and they weren't paying that much attention because they thought these agencies were taking care of the waters. Well, today what we find is between industrial agriculture, which is around the Great Lakes all over, we have huge algae blooms because of the animal, I call them factories, animal factories, so the big factory farms, the big monocultures, so they spray tons of herbicides and glyphosate on those. That's causing the algae blooms. We have a ton of, you know, people hear about the plastic problem in the oceans, but the Great Lakes have a huge plastic problem as well. It's like 22 million pounds of plastic a year are dumped into the Great Lakes. We also have a lot of nuclear power plants that are along the Great Lakes. Several of them have been shut down, but now with the AI and the data centers that all these big tech companies want, Microsoft is actually talking about reopening Three Mile Island, which was shut down because of an accident in the 70s. And so there's talk of other of these nuclear power plants that are very old. And they're, you know, they're not in good shape. And so even with the Fukushimas and the Chernobyls of the world that we've heard about, you know, they're still talking about this. It's total, like, I think, insanity. There's also an industrial wind is being proposed for the Great Lakes. Well, that has never been done in fresh water before. We have lots of industrial wind farms on land, but and, you know, and there's issues with vibrations and them leaking and, you know, all kinds of issues. But putting them in the Great Lakes, should we or shouldn't we? And, you know, so that's a key, too, with this law on rights of nature. The way rights of nature laws work in other countries like Ecuador, which we also helped them draft some of that language in their constitution, they now are having court cases come out of Ecuador that are ruling, and the judges are ruling in favor of nature and using the rights of nature language. So the way it works is a project is proposed, say it's a mining project, and the people there are like, wait a minute, we think this is going to harm our environment here and whatever the watershed or whatever it is, and they go to court. Well, then they go to court and say, provide all their evidence. Now the corporation who's doing the project has to also prove to the court why what their project is won't harm the environment. which here we don't have that. That's what I'm saying. You can't do that beforehand. You have to wait until the project goes in, the harm occurs, and then we have to try to find, you know, lawyers and pay all this money to try to get into court to prove that and then feel that money can somehow fix the problem.
Well, laws on the rights of nature have had a foothold here in Oregon as well, where I'm speaking to you from, with Lincoln County passing an aerial pesticide ban in 2017, though that has since been struck down by courts because of the extensive rights that timber companies have in Oregon state law to spray pesticides. Are there lessons to take from that saga? I want to kind of connect that to what we've seen closer to home here.
Oh, yeah. And that CELDEF worked with that group very closely. We were the law firm that, you know, helped them, assisted them along the way. So, yeah, it's very similar to what happened in Ohio. Like I said, I'm in Ohio, also passed a lot of rights of nature laws, and what we saw were challenges. And that's because the status quo system, and that just highlights and shows what the problem is with our current system. Like, you have to just accept that it's legal, and it's because it's permitted by the state and the government to spray aerial pesticides all over you and your community and your ecosystem of what you're a part of. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. So you understand it better than most communities across the United States who haven't experienced that firsthand. And that's what we're saying. This is a systemic problem that needs to change. And that's why rights of nature could change that, because if you, as that community in Lane County, were legally allowed to stand up and say, we're part of this ecosystem, this forest ecosystem, and you're harming us as well as, you know, the natural environment that we are a part of. So that's the shift that we're trying to make. But what we realized is a lot, it's actually a cultural problem as well as a legal problem. And I always pose the question to people, does the law change culture, or does culture change the law? And so, you know, what we've come to realize with groups like Lane County and Toledo, Ohio, and Columbus, Ohio, and Youngstown, and all the ones throughout the United States that we've worked with, it's a cultural problem too, because our legal system separates nature from humans, but so does our culture. You know, we believe that humans are above nature, that we're separate from it, we're here to manage it. It's a resource for us to just use and exploit for our benefit only. And, you know, not saying and putting blame on it, that's just the culture we've all been born into. And so there's a bigger cultural shift that I think has to happen where people really connect, including the judges and the lawyers and the CEOs of those companies, because that's what I kind of, you know, think about a lot of times, like even with the Great Lakes and what's going on with you guys out there, they have to live there too. They don't see themselves as part of the ecosystem either. And why would you poison? So every permit that the government hands out to a corporation to do some harm to the natural environment, they're actually legalizing and permitting the harm to the humans in that environment as well. But we don't talk about it that way. We don't see it that way. And so there's this also shift in cultural thinking that has to happen, I think, to help the laws change. You know, because I always say, what are the laws? The laws are, should represent the values of the people in that community or where we live. And right now, I think what we have is just laws representing the values of industry and the corporate side of things.
If our listeners are interested in learning more about the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund or the rights of nature more broadly, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can go to our website. So that's just celdf.org. And you'll find lots of information. You can click on rights of nature. And there's also, if they're interested in just signing a support letter for the Great Lakes Bill of Rights, because it's not that that's a petition and it's not going to make change like legally, but it's interesting because it's a way to share it with other people just to get the idea across. Because that's the other thing that really hit me after the Lake Erie Bill of Rights and working closely with that effort is that, because what we saw is huge pushback, which you guys also saw in Oregon, right? Like, we don't, even though we have a democracy and you followed all the rules to put a law on the ballot, they find ways to keep it off the ballot. They don't want the people to vote, and they don't want people to learn about these new ideas that might change the status quo system. So the sharing of the idea is really important at this phase in the movement. So that's the reason why we have the support letter, because it also then, if you sign it, maybe you'll say, hey, to your friends, I signed this really interesting, you know, bill, it's in New York and I know it's not here, but read it, you know, because, and then maybe people there will want to try something. Maybe you can find a legislator in Oregon who will want to, you know, formulate something similar to the Great Lakes and New York Waters bill.
Well, Tish, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I love sharing this idea with as many people as I can. You made that possible.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
The thrills continue here on KBOO as the Monday Sampler, starting April 14th at 2 p.m., will present throughout the rest of April episodes from the lives of Harry